I don't remember the exact date.
And the year?
It was in November 1944.
So you tried?
Because my appointment to Avalon was, as I remember, the 1st of December 1944.
Well, what was the November date? You just looked up the 24th of November.
Well, I think it was.
Yeah. Well,
it's not on
not
there.
Not on there, no. So you transferred to the RCN on the 24th of November 1944. And I take note back in the tape, you first applied for the RCN on the 28th of November 1929.
That's right.
So you served a longer period.
It was a long haul. And I had to find the key to the back door.
And you transferred as a lieutenant, acting lieutenant commander, acting commander while holding appointment.
Yeah, that was so as not to disturb anybody who'd been RCN from the beginning.
Yes, that's right. And you were told you'd have to take your examinations in due course.
Yeah, which I did.
Did you get your volunteer decoration?
I did, like a pig's ear. They gypped me out of it. Nobody paid any attention to it. And, of course, not long after that, the VD became the VRD, the Volunteer Reserve Decoration. But I still wish I had VD after my name.
Yes.
I've got CD, which is my initials. I call it the Charles Dillon Medal.
Yes.
The Canadian Forces
yes,
Decoration.
Of course.
Well, but I only picked that up in RCN time.
Yeah,
well, anyway, Avalon.
The first one read more like a medical history sheet than a decoration.
Yeah, exactly.
CD Dillon, CD.
Yeah.
VD. All right.
VD. A lot of the old VR, people like Bud Atwood, he had his VD and he had his CD as well, and a lot of others. I guess old Jeffrey Vanstone Brock had a VD, and I don't know that he puts it in his books and things, but anyway.
There are some CDs in the reserve today, and I always look upon those on a reserve officer's chest with considerable respect, because I know the hours and weeks, well, the hours and hours he's put in to get that CD. It doesn't mean much for a permanent force officer, but in a reserve officer, it denotes extraordinary devotion to the Navy.
Oh, indeed it does.
As the VD would have done for you.
Yeah. Well,
anyway, it's on record.
It's funny to see captains today with just the CD.
Yeah. And higher. Well, they've got Canadian decorations.
Well, they've got the OMM, but the Army are more liberally supplied with ribbons because they get one for their peacekeeping and various other.
Yeah, well, that top one on those ribbons over there is my son's for serving. He was in the Canadian Guards.
Oh, yeah.
And he served in Cyprus.
That's right. Well, my son served in Cyprus, and he's got my son has a funny medal that he got for his time with ICCS in Vietnam. It's made of plastic. It was made in Pakistan or somewhere. Ended up to everyone who was there.
That's the four generations of us. My son, me, my father, my son, his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. So that's a nice collection
very
for
nice
a family to have.
Very nice.
Okay. Now, where were we?
Avalon.
Yes.
I had just joined. Newfoundland, I always thought, was a darn good place to serve. It was an operational base, and people didn't go around with pomp and circumstance. The whole base existed for only one purpose, and that was to support the ships, the mid-ocean escort groups, and those are the western escort groups that came our way. As I recall, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 9,000 people in the shore staff. That was the command headquarters, Flag Officer Newfoundland, who was CRH Taylor, the dockyard, Buckmaster's Field, and all the sort of ancillary services. We had a sub-base of repair depot at Bay Bulls, and there was a very good spirit in the base, and of course one of the nice things that you saw so many people that you knew came in ships, and you were able to renew a lot of friendships. As far as I was concerned in my job, I had the usual things that one would expect. Pay Division 1 was down on the South Shore, and they looked after the pay accounts of all the people afloat. Pay Division 2 was in the Buckmaster's Field area, and we looked after all the pay accounts of people who were on the shore staff, including the command staff. We had our usual stores and victualling. We had the St. John's Naval Canteen, which was a big operation, operated purely by the St. John's base. And when I first arrived, the captain of Avalon was Captain, I think his initials are S.M. Davis. Sammy Davis. He lives out in Sydney now. We met him at a party just a couple of years ago, and his wife was talking to my wife, and she turned to a third person and said, "You know, this lady's husband was my husband's bookkeeper in Newfoundland." Which I thought was a somewhat ungracious way of putting it. Anyway, he was succeeded in the course of time Jack Connolly.
Jack Connolly?
Connolly. He was an RCNVR captain from Charlottetown, an old pre-war VR.
Is this the one that wore the RCN stripes with a slight faint wiggle in them to show that he was RCNVR, the one that had charge of the Navy show? No.
No, that was Joe Connolly.
It was Joe, right.
No, this was
Jack
Connolly, and he had a brother called Charlie Connolly, I think. All very confusing. Anyway, nothing much of note happened there that is worthy of being registered in the tablets for history, except VE Day. And in view of the fact that there's such trauma in Halifax, I think it merits saying a few words about St. John's, Newfoundland on VE Day. We had been warned, I guess, about 2 weeks previous to the 8th of May to make preparations. And I guess there must have been warnings prior to that. But they'd only filtered down to likes of me about 2 weeks. And there were a whole series of planning meetings of what we would do. And they were concerned, but the relations with the Newfoundlanders appeared to be pretty good. I didn't recall any. And I don't think that living was very expensive there, but I don't think that the naval people, who were, after all, were looked upon as foreigners, and a sort of army of occupation, I don't think we were gouged anything like the Halifax gouged the naval people, especially the married ones. Anyway, we had a very definite, detailed, strict plans for the occasion when it arrived. All wardrooms were to be closed for the entire day. All officers, this was shore-based officers, were required for special duties, either as fire pickets or to assist the shore patrol or to be available for any crisis that might arise. They arranged for various, there were going to be some couple of dances and things like that. And in the St. John's Naval Canteen, we had put aside a reserve stock of 2,500 cases of quart bottles of beer. They also had a very good scheme in Newfoundland, which somebody introduced, I don't know who it was. Liquor there wasn't rationed anywhere like it was in Canada. Newfoundland was not Canada. I have an idea that you could buy a 26-ounce bottle a week. And the joke of it was that it was all $4 a bottle, spirits. It didn't matter whether it was Johnny Walker Black Label or Screech, it was $4 a bottle. The troops would buy their bottles, and they set up a locker system in the guardhouse at Buckmaster's Field. And if you bought a bottle and only drank a third of it, when you came in the gate, it was put in a little locker, and the level was marked, and your name was on it. So people didn't feel that they had to finish the bottle. So that helped a lot. Well, VE Day dawned. We went through all this sort of nonsense on the day before, you know, the false reports and everything. And the arrangements, the plan went into high gear. We had a parade and a memorial service on the parade ground and in the forenoon. And then we started issuing beer to all the people that were in barracks. The shore patrol had been augmented. The fire departments were all standing by. And of course the orders issued to ships were the same as they were in Halifax. Lock up all ready-use ammunition lockers and pyrotechnic lockers and arms and everything else. But the sirens all sounded and hooters and whatnot. We passed out beer and the galleys were serving meals on a sort of continuous basis, which is a good idea. And by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there wasn't a single sailor downtown. Any that had been downtown the forenoon behaved themselves. Now, I don't remember whether the liquor stores were open or the restaurants were closed or not, because it never came up. People were being fed in Buckmaster's Field.
Plenty of beer.
There was plenty of beer.
Free?
Free.
And they had their own, like, a buy bottles?
Had their bottles in the thing. There were a lot of drunks. I remember sitting in the mess hall talking to one of the cooks who was weaving around, who was married to a lieutenant nursing officer, but they were all very cheery and everything. Unfortunately, I had to prosecute a court-martial which had been due to start at 10 o'clock. It was a case of buggery on board a frigate where the two involved were caught in flagrante
delicto.
Delicto. A sub-lieutenant and a telegraphist. And for some unknown reason, I was told that I had to prosecute.
I presume the sub was on top. Alma will take that out.
Yes, I hope Alma will be broad-minded about this. But anyway, we didn't get the court-martial underway till 5 o'clock. because it was hard to round up the people. But the ship was due to sail the next morning with an escort group. And it may have been VE Day, but nobody said the war at sea was over. So we went at it. And I must confess, this was the first time I'd ever prosecuted. And it was not that easy. I had, there were various doctors who were witnesses for the prosecution, and I found them extremely difficult to pin down to anything. These two characters were being tried together. But anyway, in the course of time, I've made my summing up, but it seemed to be like an open and shut case to me. And the court brought in a verdict of guilty as charged and sentenced both these birds to be dismissed the service. It was then midnight, so I went home. We had a funny little house just behind Buckmaster's Field, so I could walk there very quickly. And I had my first drink to celebrate the end of the war at that point.
Gosh.
And that was that. Well, that saw the end of the war in Europe. I remained in Newfoundland until mid-July as we wound down in a great hurry. The establishment and people kept leaving in great numbers. I'd sent my wife and child home in the meantime to the West Coast because I had been appointed to Magnificent. It was supposed to be completing in Belfast to go to the Pacific, so people say. Some wizard at headquarters decided that I should go to Naden in Esquimalt to do a one-week course and some new pay record from Newfoundland. And I sent my wife and child to Ottawa, I guess, initially, to stay with my mother. And I took passage in a frigate from St. John's to Quebec. She was going up to pay off. And I was treated very well by the captain. And I was given the settee in his sleeping cabin. The only thing that he didn't tell me was that the thing was infested with fleas, and I was chewed to death on passage. But anyway, I picked up my family in...
Heard of cockroaches and rats, but not fleas.
Well, this was fleas. Spent a few days in Ottawa. Took the train.
With Winston and your child?
Yes, the child was then about 20 months old, I guess.
The child was just the first
Patrick,
one.
Patrick. And, of course, train travel wasn't the greatest fun in those days. The trains were crowded. You had to line up for meals, and it was... On the way through the Rocky Mountains, we heard that VJ Day had come around, and I wondered about my appointment. I went right to Naden and did my course in 5 days, and then I was told that I was proceeding on 30 days annual leave and 30 days Pacific leave.
What about survivor's leave? Did you get that?
No, I didn't.
Never got your survivor's leave?
Because I hadn't had any leave for a year anyway in Nabob, so, you know, other than that odd day. I went off on leave from Naden and went up to Salt Spring Island, where my wife and son were staying with her parents. And I was there exactly 10 days when a telephone call came saying that my appointment to Magnificent had been cancelled and that I was to leave immediately for Sydney.
Nova Scotia.
I'd just come from St. John's, Newfoundland. So I gathered myself together and I spent 5 days and 6 nights on a train, CNR, and I arrived in Point Edward, eventually, in Newfoundland. Cape Breton, and took over as the supply officer of HMCS Protector. I was told that the appointment there would be for 2 years, that Point Edward was to be a peacetime base for the Navy. About a month and a half later, I got a phone call to say that I was to come to Ottawa for a meeting with the Director General of SFA, as he was known in those days, Supply and Fleet Accounting. In the meantime, I was scratching around Sydney looking for a place for my family to live. And the bass was just coming down around my ears. People were leaving. Ships would come in, corvettes and frigates and bangers, and they were destoring them.
Not the way you destored Nabob.
No. Well, I don't think they were that fussy. But and lifting the armament off them, etc. And as I say, the place was just crumbling around my ears, and I couldn't picture it lasting for 2 years. The day before I was due to leave for Ottawa for this short meeting, I got another phone call saying to pack all my gear and come, that I was going to stay in Ottawa and to turn over the job of supply officer protector to some other character whose name escapes me now, who was also a commander S. So I did that in the hours that were left, and I got on the train and went to Ottawa.
What rank are you now?
Oh, I was still a commander SRCN.
Are you acting lieutenant commander?
Well, yes, I was, and in the meantime, I had passed my exams. When I got to Ottawa, I was the director of Naval Air Supply, and also I had another hat of director of Fleet Stores. And the only notable thing about that, as I took over an office which had previously been occupied by a Lieutenant Reuben, whose name came into prominence not long after that in the Guzenko affair.
That's R-E-U-B-E-N.
Yes.
Reuben, yeah.
He obviously was one of the baddies because I forget whether he was convicted or not at this point, but anyway, he was. I had heard, or did hear in the years after, that he was behind the Iron Curtain somewhere. Well, there's the end of my...
We're well into 1945 now, aren't we? You're in Ottawa.
Yeah, well, I was there. Is there any point in going post-war?
I have a couple of questions, but you're in Ottawa at the end of 1945.
That's right.
Okay, that's good enough for now. Yes, I have a question. Were you asked to volunteer for the Pacific?
Oh, yes.
What did
We were all asked to volunteer for the Pacific.
What did you think about that?
Well, it didn't. It seemed to me that I'd spent my entire naval life volunteering or swearing allegiance to some character who happened to be occupying the throne. I remember going in.
A lot of people resented it.
Yes, and made a big fuss about it. I remember going into the flag officer. I knew Commodore First Class C.R.H. Taylor pretty well for many years, and his secretary was an old friend of mine, David Cromarty, who was a Commander S also. And I went in there to, ask what people were doing about this. And David Cromarty told me, he's a judge now, Ontario Supreme Court, or Court of Queen's Bench or something. David said, I took the form in to the Commodore, and he looked at it and grumped and said, well, if it's going to make him any happier, I'll sign. He signed. Well, he just say,
Cuth Taylor.
Yeah. All his officers signed, to my knowledge. I also got into hot water with the command supply officer, was an RN, Captain S by that time, called Driscoll. And he and I never saw eye to eye at any time. He was the command supply officer, and I was the senior supply officer, HMCS Avalon. And at the end of the, after VE Day...
We're back in Newfoundland?
Yeah, well, yeah. This is, has some relativity. Yeah. Captain Wright, as he was then, the DGSFA...
Tony.
Sent me several messages saying who had volunteered for the Pacific and who did I recommend of the people I had under me to be sent, to be reappointed for Pacific. This was in late May and June, 45. And I did this, and I thought the polite thing to do was to tell Driscoll about it, which I did at a party at Fort William, which was the headquarters. Gee whiz, Driscoll accused me of just about everything in the book, dismembering the British Empire and all the rest of it. He said, all you're trying to do is make a big fellow out of yourself. I said, look, it's my Navy, not yours. And we didn't part on very good terms.
Well, this caused, as you know, a lot of embarrassment to Sir Bruce, because one of his cruisers had to go home.
Yeah.
And did you hear anything about how Uganda troops felt about that at the time?
Well, only, hearsay aftermath. No. I talked to some of the people who were involved in it, who were serving in the ship.
Yeah.
The most charitable thing I can say is that it must have been very badly handled.
The phrasing of the message was badly phrased.
Well, but I think...
It kind of implied, home.
I think the... I never saw the message that was sent to Uganda, but the whole business of asking people to re-volunteer could have been sold, I feel, and it obviously wasn't. Now, I don't know why it wasn't. I've heard some people who opinions on this, but I have nothing to contribute on that because, honestly, I don't know.
Tell me the names of the people you spoke to who were in Uganda. Can you do that so that I can contact them?
Henry McCandless.
Henry McCandless
was the supply officer.
Yeah. Is he an MAC or an MC?
MC.
MC, capital C-A-N-D.
Well, he lives here in Victoria.
Yeah, I'll talk to Henry.
He's a sick man, I think.
Oh, well, we'll do the best. He's sick, eh?
Dick White was a air defense officer or something like that. Sky aft or something.
Yeah, which Dick White and where's he now?
Well, he's in Ottawa. He...
Oh, he was the one that was... He was CEO of Carlton later on.
Yeah, he's the chairman of the board of the British American Bank Note Company.
He was, yes, indeed. He is.
I think he still is.
Yeah.
And he's been very active in the Naval Benevolent Fund, the Corps of Commissionaires, and goodness knows
what. Which you have. So there's Dickie White, Henry McCandless.
I think some of the others that were... I'd have to look at a Navy list of that period. That's 58, that wouldn't have.
No good. What was the tenor of their remarks then?
If I can ask you to remember that far back, and what must have been a casual conversation?
Well, as far as I remember, the ones I spoke to had all volunteered. I think it has to be remembered that now Uganda became a Canadian ship in Charleston, North Carolina, I think, in 1944 at some period. And she sailed from Portsmouth, and I believe she called at Halifax, and then she went off through the Med, she went off to the Pacific.
Mook Magic left her in the Med because he wouldn't sign.
No, but that was Ontario.
Yeah, sorry. Never mind. No, it's fine.
I don't want to criticize Mook Magic. I think he was a twerp on more than one occasion. Let's leave it to that.
Yes.
Because you recall, he went to the IDC in the 60s, and because he didn't approve of integration and unification, he resigned in the middle of the course. Now, I was always under the impression that when you went to a staff course or one of these old gentlemen's finishing schools, you had to sign a piece of paper to say that you would continue to serve for 5 years or at the service pleasure. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you had to pay them something. Now, I know from my own experience that attendance at the IDC was very expensive because, first of all, the Navy lost our service during that period, and there were a lot of extra allowances and things which you got over your base pay. It was a privilege and an honor to take one of these courses. But I don't think it was the sort of thing that you suddenly said, I don't believe in this nonsense, I'm going to quit.
No.
What you should have been done is you should have been fired.
Yes.
Now, that's only my personal opinion.
Well, of course, but...
But in the case of the Ontario, Magic was the gunnery officer and had taken a number of courses on the ship's armament. He had stood by her fitting out pre-commissioning time as the gunnery officer, and he was the most knowledgeable of the gunnery department, I presume. Now, when he wouldn't volunteer, they were hard put to find somebody who had the same qualifications.
Yeah.
And I don't know who it was, you may.
And they were going out to shoot their guns, too.
They were going out to shoot their guns. Their bad luck, they got there after the shooting was over. But the same way, I don't remember who the gunnery officer of Uganda was. But if I remember rightly, in Uganda, the officers in the main, in the majority, all volunteered, but it was the troops who didn't. And this is where it really fouled things up. But, you see, this volunteering business was, in my opinion, was invented for the army. And bear in mind that a great many of the people in the army had gone overseas in 39, 40, 41, and it was now 45. And they'd been in action after a long period of sitting around exercising.
That's several years of exercising.
Yes. They'd been in action in Italy, Sicily in Italy, and in Northwest Europe. I guess, quite rightly, they wanted to go home. And so this volunteering for the Pacific was done to, the carrot was offered that you would get 30 days leave in addition to your annual leave or other leave entitlements, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It didn't really apply to the Navy as well, although there were people who had spent 5-6 years in the North Atlantic and who were essentially in the same boat. Now, some volunteered, some didn't. But I don't recall, because it never crossed my bow, you might say, that there was any shortage of people for our commitment to the Pacific Force. I don't think. I still think that old Cuff Taylor had the right idea when he said, well, if it's going to make them any happier, I'll sign.
Well, I think that might sum up that aspect. You asked if we should go on, but you have some knowledge of Korea. That was really one of our proudest moments. The Air Force couldn't provide, when the United Nations asked us, could we contribute towards a police force, the minister called the three chiefs in, and the Air Force said, well, they couldn't actually provide anybody to fight in Korea, but they could provide 6 transports to go between Seattle and Tokyo.
North Stars.
And North Stars. And I presume then the naval minister asked the soldier chief, and he said, well, he could get a battalion there by Christmas. This was in late June. And he did get a battalion there by Christmas, the Princess Patricia's. And he didn't get a larger force there until a year later. And when he asked Harold Grant what could the Navy do, Harold Grant had been in touch with Harry DeWolfe.
No, was it Harry? Or
Harry DeWolfe was FOPC.
Or was it Wallace Prairie?
No, it was Harry DeWolfe.
Harry DeWolfe.
You told me. And Harry said, because they had fixed it this way, they brought men in from barracks for a practice. The ships were up to war complement. They had stored them, fueled them, ammunitioned them. And it must have been a very proud moment for Harry Grant when he said, well, he said, I'll have 3 destroyers at sea on their way tomorrow. And so any light you can shed, and they were there within a month in off Korea.
Oh yeah,
Cayuga, Athabascan, and Sioux.
I'm checking the. Yeah. I came out here at the end of June 1950, I was appointed the command supply officer and the manager of the supply department in the dockyard, which was a sort of bogus title we had until we reorganized the thing. We had a naval supply depot. And I arrived, I took up my appointment the very day the ship sailed. I saw them sail. But you remember that originally the three destroyers were going to leave the West Coast. Now that was Cayuga, Athabascan, and
Sioux.
And they were going to Europe.
Yes.
And they were going to do a real Banyan trip around Northern Europe. J.V. Brock was the Captain D, or whatever he called himself at that time. And he had gone great pains to make sure that his ships were in the highest state of preparedness for the tour. And, you know, they had all new silver cutlery and china and all the glasses they need. And there was difficulty finding storage space for all the wines and spirits that were required. So they had to empty some of the magazines.
Oh dear. Regular peacetime routine.
Empty the shell rooms and magazines for the booze.
That's right. And everything was, well, they suddenly got the word they were going off to join a war on the other side of the world. And there was this took place, I must say, immediately prior to my arrival, but I quickly heard about it. But they had to take all the booze out of the magazines and things, and the extra mess traps, and the extra crystal, etc.
It must have been an unusual pipe. Yeah. Debark booze, embark ammunition.
That's right. But they went off, and as you say, they were it was a proud moment.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Lawrence. The only thing you can add about Korea
is I would have liked to have got over there to see how our ships were being looked after, but I was unable to convince anyone that this was going to add to the success of the war. But I did convince the powers that be that we should send a supply liaison officer, who would be stationed in Sasebo. And Peter Cassette was selected, and a most satisfactory and suitable appointment it was, because Peter was always a go-getter, and he liked that sort of thing much better than being a secretary, which he was his fate a lot of the time. Peter went over there and made a really significant contribution to the logistic support of our ships, and it was a nowadays, you know, we wouldn't send any ships off into the blue without, say, Provider or one of the other ships to go with them and act as a backup. But we sent these three destroyers off, and we had our problems. I remember one time we got a frantic message from, they were on their way across from one of the ships, I forget which one it was either Athabascan or Cayuga, that there was some vital piece of spare part machinery that they needed because they couldn't continue without it. And we had one in the stores in Squamaw, and we packed it up and sent it on its happy way.
Via RCAF, I presume?
No, via U.S. to Pearl Harbor.
To Pearl. Mm.
And they delivered it on board, and the ship carried on without any undue delay.
But well, that's kind of it. That's the interesting thing. We've had nothing so far on the logistic backup. Just shooting at trains.
Mm-hmm. Well, the ships were by and large supported by the Americans in Sasebo and the American underway replenishment people. At one time...
We're coming to the end, so okay. I'll turn the tape over now. They were supplied, what did you say, enlarged by the USN supply people.
Replenishment, yeah. Replenishment. And their replenishment forces afloat.